Hello there. You're very welcome to this very special episode of Burning Books in collaboration with the wonderful Dublin Book Festival. I'm very pleased to welcome author Andrew Meehan as our guest today. His debut novel, One Star Awake, was longlisted for the 2018 Desmond Elliott Prize, the UK's most prestigious award for debut novelists. His second book, The Mystery of Love, is a moving and unique reimagining of the relationship between Oscar and Constance Wilde. His latest novel, Instant Fires, is out now with New Island. I was looking there at your book that you chose from your early days, and it's interesting because a lot of people go straight back to like childhood, but you go for a very literary novel. And I'm just going to read the first line of it because I know that for people listening, they can, you know, shout out in the living room what it is. But it was inevitable. The scent of bitter almonds always reminded him of the fate of unrequited love. And that's the first line. Oh, I got a little shiver there. That's the first line from?
It's the first line from Love in the Time of Cholera, Gabriel Garcia Marquez. Well, it's my early days, Ruth. I read it when I was 18.
Okay.
That's your childhood.
You're still a young one. Yeah.
You really are. And I read it, and it was a book you had to read at the time. I don't know if it's a book that people still feel they have to read. It felt like it was on the reading list for life. I read it, and it just turned me upside down. I was a young romantic. I'm a middle-aged romantic now, mm-hmm. I think. And I remember once I was on an inter-rating trip with my girlfriend at the time in France, and she was reading the ending. And she was crying so profoundly and so much that there was people on the train asking her, was she okay? Was there anything I'd done to her? Because she was crying so much, crying so intensely. And I had something of a similar physical reaction to it. So the reason why I call back to it and think back to it is because, I mean, all endings are about the getting there. But it's most people know, and it doesn't disturb your reading of the book to know that it's a story of a love story that lasts, endures separate, a love affair that endures over 50 years and a couple are apart for that time, and they come back around together. So it's a love story about a reunion. So it is a love story about an ending. And I've been thinking lately about endings and what would it be like to write a book that makes somebody cry on the train? And somebody asked me about my most recent novel, Instant Fires, which is another, it's a love story with a much shorter span. It's a love story that takes place over a week. And somebody said to me, would you not write a book with a happy ending, Andrew? And I went, I thought I had. So the thing I'm working on right now, I'm trying to think, okay, I really want to end with a wallop. An emotional wallop, and Love in the Time of Cholera. I mean, it gets you from the first page. You read. I mean, we could sit here and read lines to each other.
I'm just thinking. I'm going to interrupt you because you just said endings, and you know, thinking about endings and thinking about Ishiguro. You know, if you're talking about ending on a gut punch, an emotional gut punch, you think of The Remains of the Day, which is just absolutely devastating.
That was very nearly on my list to talk to you about today, and God, I might go now to the shelf after this and pick it off and read it over my lunch. But the endings are all about the getting there. I used to have this really bad habit when I was a youth. I was standing in bookshops reading the final pages of books just to get the crescendo.
Oh, I'm a monster.
But you can't write a book that's all crescendo, and endings aren't necessarily about that sort of the operatic strings either. So there's another book that I read recently. It's a Scottish novel by Andrew O'Hagan called Mayflies. And it's a book about a man recalling a friendship of his youth. And it builds up to this ending, which the final paragraph is it is the imagery, the way the entire book lands on its feet in this closing paragraph. And, you know, there's nothing showy about that closing paragraph, and it is all about the getting there, as I've said.
Do you think that there's a sense, do you think that inevitability
you know, lends itself to that, you know, back to Ishiguro, there's an inevitability with, and just thinking with Márquez there, it was inevitable is how that book starts. You know, is inevitability something that as a reader, you know, you're even more sort of conflicted, invested in that because you kind of know how it's going to end.
You do, and you have, if the book has the sort of the right kind of narrative desire and the right kind of frustration and the interplay between sort of narrative desire and narrative frustration, and if it takes you there, and yes, it's not all about, you know, we're talking about love stories, you know, here. It's not always about, you know, the rom-com ending. It's not always about will they, won't they. It's about, is there a sense of, oh God, I don't know why I'm using this expression, but I might try and explore it. Emotional justice. Is there a sense of this is the right way for the book to end? And again, it doesn't have to be that a book has a big third act in the way that a sort of a movie would have.
If you think of Mike McCormack, if you think of Solar Bones, you know, of endings that are sort of, well, that's, I mean, it's poetic, it's circular, it ends in a sort of beautiful melancholy kind of cadence, like perfect cadence, but just
it really does.
Just or maybe it's, I don't know whether it's a whisper or a scream at the end of that book, or a triumph, or all of them, you know.
I go, but there's a passage about, is it maybe 5-10 pages from the end of Solar Bones when the character is having a sandwich. He's sitting in the cafe. Is he in Lewisburg or in Ballinara or somewhere in May? And he's having, and it's just before he goes. I mean, it's just before.
No, but don't spoil it. Yes.
Well, he is dead, I suppose, at the start of the book. But it is before one of the sort of the big events towards the end of the book. And he's having a sandwich, and you're thinking, this is the best moment of reverie and grace that I think I've ever read on a page. And it happens to be a guy having a sandwich in a sort of fairly ordinary cafe in the northwest of Ireland. God, I might read that after this as well. It's lovely. And that was very nearly on the list as well. So endings are, I'd love to write an ending that made somebody cry in the train. And but maybe even if the fact that having that in mind might mean I might force it. So you have to be very careful about what you do. And you never know until you go back over it and you read the full manuscript.
And would you find, as a writer, do you think endings are the hardest? I mean, that's a bit of a facile question. I don't mean that difficulty, but I mean, are they... Would you, as a writer, do you struggle with them, or it sounds like you invest a lot of?
I invest a lot. I mean, structure is important to all writers. For instance, my second novel, The Mystery of Love, I had that ending in mind all along. I had that structure, and I had a structure in mind for The Mystery of Love, and I wrote this, and I planned it, and I wrote it, and that was the novel it became. For my first book, One Star Awake, I had a particular ending in mind, and then I wrote it, and most people said to me, it's not finished. And I went, well, it is. And I continued beyond the point of my initial ending.
So you sort of write to a sense of an ending, to a sense, to an emotional justice like you're talking about, rather than a particular event or happening or consequence. It's you want the reader to experience that.
You do. I suppose what you're doing is you're starting with some, when we're talking about emotions here, you're starting with some kind of emotional equilibrium. And your job, our job is to come along and sort of disturb that equilibrium, agitate it, throw it all around the place, and then try and leave the characters and or the reader, maybe they'll be in different places, but leave them with a new equilibrium. And it really depends on, and that sounds very precious, and I don't care. Whatever is the equilibrium that you feel you can leave the reader with, a feeling of not necessarily closure, but some kind of satisfaction. Because they like to talk about my third book, my current book, that's an ending that is almost, it's a very quiet, circumstantial, almost cut to black type ending. If Instant Fires was a film, it would be a European art movie with a long second act and no third act. And that felt right. Because people have said to me, "Oh, the book ends," and I go, "Yeah, it does." But this is just a little. Instant Fires is just a week long slice of a relationship, and it felt right to just have an ending. If you can think of I just thought there of the film Big Night, It's a film that a lot of people, with starring Stanley Tucci and Campbell Scott, about two brothers, or Stanley Tucci is one of two brothers who run an Italian restaurant, and they've had a big, big fight on the beach. And then the film ends. They're just sitting in the kitchen making either scrambled eggs or an omelette. And I kind of wanted, let's have a scrambled eggs or an omelette in the kitchen kind of ending.
I'm seeing a bit of a thread going through here. We've had a sandwich. Now we're on to omelettes. Yes. You know, we're going for great satisfaction and a little bite to eat, you know.
A lot of people have, I don't think there's a page of my fiction that doesn't have somebody consuming at least a packet of crisps.
Look, it sounds like you're drawn to love stories. Everyone's drawn to love stories, but you know, from Love in the Time of Cholera onto the next choice here is a book that you return to. Well, you wouldn't maybe say it was a love story, but it's back to a couple again. It's back to a relationship. Is it between a couple, the book that you would return to, or that you do return to?
The book I return to is, well, it's a collection of stories. So it's a collection that I can really dip into. And it's by a writer who I return to again and again. Her work overall is Amy Bloom. And Amy Bloom, she wrote a beautiful or a very sad memoir recently called In Love, which I'd recommend. But she has this collection called Where the God of Love Hangs Out, which is, it's published by Granta, and it's got I quite like the unwieldy title. And it's a collection, it's a collection of interlinked stories, or half of the book is interlinked stories. So it reads in the way that, you know, Olive Kitteridge, you know, is Olive Kitteridge a novel or a collection of stories? And the part of Where the God of Love Hangs Out that I return to again and again is, I'll read here from the book blurb. It says, in a set of interlocking stories, two middle-aged friends married to others find themselves irresistibly drawn to one another. When they decide to risk their happy, complacent marriages for the sharp delights of a late-life affair, we follow them with trepidation through their heady early days. And the reason I love Amy Bloom is that, you know, we've all got access to sadness. We've all got access to the distressing parts of life. But she writes about pleasure in a way that I find, it's almost ineffable. She writes about, there's always a subtext to the pleasure. There's always like, the pleasure is fleeting. The pleasure is illicit. The pleasure is going to go away. The pleasure wasn't yours. The pleasure isn't pleasurable really to begin. It's always barbed in some way, but it also exists in terms of, God, this is just lovely. And I think, you know, life is about pleasure too. I find her, I think maybe her worldview, I wish I could share. I feel like I read her work and I think, God, she's in love with the world, and her characters are in love with the world. And that's something that, you know, I write for escapism and I read for escapism. You won't find any of society in my work. My work isn't in any way issue driven other than the issues of love. And Amy Bloom is really, really smart on what it is to be in love and what it is to be alive, I think.
Yeah, I think we're nodding along there about the happy complacency and then the late life affair. Would you have a passage from that you could?
Why don't I read the opening? Is it, again, because it's sort of more, and it might lead you in there. This, the opening story is called From Where the God of Love Hangs Out by Amy Bloom. The opening story is called Your Borders, Your Rivers, Your Tiny Villages. At 2 o'clock in the morning, no one is to blame. We've been watching CNN, one scene of disaster leading to the next, the reporter in front of what might have been a new anthrax outbreak giving way to the military analyst in the studio with new developments in Kabul, when William put his hand on my breast. My husband was asleep upstairs, dreaming of making the deal that would put us on high ground when the entire economy collapsed. And William's wife was asleep in the guest room, getting her restorative 8 hours. I think of Isabel as forcefully regular and elegant in all of her habits. And I'm sure she thinks of me as a little askew in all of mine.
Ooh, I love that.
So that's like 80 words. And that's the entire setup. The entire setup is there. And she resolves it without resolving it, and there's so much tenderness and so much kindliness, but people do suffer, people do die, people do get sick, but there's always a sense of the author is looking on with a certain fondness for these people.
So, yeah, even in that, there's a kind of a wry tone. It's sharp. Well, But
indeed, indeed. Well, the wryness is it, and the wryness and the warmth and the, but there's always a kind of a rigor underneath it, and she's always, well, she's, I suppose your job is to you do have to make people suffer, I suppose, and she's kind of, she does, she, you know, sad things do occur.
Which leads us nicely on, because we're talking about sadness and sad things.
Oh, God, yeah, we've been all day talking about sadness.
Yeah, well, I know. This is, you know, you've mentioned here that, you know, in your 20s you were, well, you use the word sad. You use the word sad here, and not words like depressed or anything like that. You said that you were sad in your 20s, and that there was a book at that time that maybe you could relate to, or that made things a little better, maybe.
It really did. This is a book. This is an essay called "Goodbye to All That" by Joan Didion, and it is an essay about another person being sad in their 20s. About somebody, you know, Joan Didion, when she moved, talking about moving to New York and missing home and not fitting in, and you know, it's all a very kind of elegant, tasteful sadness, and I don't mind if I, you know, sit. Succumb to all that. But at the time it really became, I mean, and again, I use the word sad, but I was probably, I had an extended period of depression in my 20s, and it just wasn't something that I wonder if I felt the way I felt then, now would you know, would the world we live in now, would I discussed it with people? It was definitely something I would not have considering it to myself, let alone discussing with other people or seeking help. But I was in bother, and it was to do with, you know, it was romantic pain that led to psychic pain that led to sort of a difficult 2 or 3 years. Now that I look at it, and I tell you, God, I photocopied. I was working I must have been unbearable to look at me in the corner of this office. I was working as a script editor for a film company, and I photocopied the essay, and I had it taped up above my desk, and I sit there and look at it, and I absorbed it, and I sort of metabolized it so much that I read it so much that I metabolized it, and I haven't read it since. And I knew I was going to talk to you about it today, Ruth, and I thought, Andrew, will you go to the shelf? Uh-huh. Oddly enough, my copy of the book, I think if I've got it right, it's from Joan Didion's collection, Slouching Towards Bethlehem. And my copy of the book was saved from a house fire, so my copy of the book has a scorched cover. But do you know what? I couldn't bear to read it again, nor to talk. So I can talk about what it was like, yes, to remember to read it then, but I don't know if I can go back there to what it was like to be 25 and quite profoundly sad, which makes it sound, again, tasteful and elegant. I was depressed and I needed help. And it wasn't all Joan Didion that got me out of it.
Yeah.
But I saw that I was able to read other people's experiences, and you know, maybe she made beauty of it, and maybe it's not. Maybe sadness isn't something to make beauty of, but
maybe it is. I mean, I was going to say to you that, you know, depression is ugly. It's a thug. You know, it's not pretty, and it's not gothically romantic. It's not, in any sense, you know, it's grim. But maybe finding something that does make an elegance out of it, or a construct out of it, is quite helpful at the time, because you can sort of, it's not even relating, it's just a sort of a kind of a nicer mirror reflection of your own misery. Yes, you know,
is. Yeah. In a way, maybe I would still classify what happened to me as sadness, because it had a source, and maybe is depression sadness without a source?
Doesn't have to have one, I guess. Yeah.
But my sadness did have a source, and I was able to resolve it and move on and get new sadnesses.
And get new sadnesses, yes. There's always another one coming along. Sometimes
there's always one coming. So.
Do you then, like, I know you say, so you say you metabolized that, and so I suppose it's inevitable then that came out in your work somehow, like in your early writing, or like when you first started writing, or were you already writing in your 20s? Like, do you think that, has that come out? Is that either what you read or the experience of the time, has that informed your work?
No, I was such a reader then. I worked as a script editor in TV and film for a very long time. I didn't write fiction until I was in my late 30s. I'm 51 now. And I didn't really start writing fiction in earnest till I was 40. And I first published short stories about 12 years ago. First published my first novel about 5-6 years ago. So I didn't think people were allowed to write. I thought writers were on posters, you know, that, you know, the poster of all the Irish writers on the wall.
Yeah.
I thought, okay, you had to be on it. I idolize writers and writing, or writers, so much that I thought they belonged in a glass case. So I just didn't think it could be done. So, but it was working in screenwriting, where writing is it seems to be a much more functional sort of schematic experience, that made me sort of that got me over that idolatry, that ridiculous idolatry. But it took me a while to, I'd written a few screenplays, but then I remember the very first time I wrote some prose, it was just a physical, something changed. I thought, okay, this exists. This is the art. This is the painting. It's not, you know, screenplays are a set of instructions for the manufacture of a feature film, but writing prose, I just had it was a different manifestation of a different feeling. And, but it took me a very long time, probably, as you can tell from my tone here, getting over myself a bit.
but maybe that's necessary. I mean, there are so many people who start writing before they've even read that much, you know, like, or you're so young, and you know, there's an advantage to that too. But surely it makes sense to, you know, when you start writing later, you have that well of your just even human experience, and you know, the novels you've read, all of that informs you. I mean, it's surely no bad thing to start writing in your late 30s.
Not at all, and I'm glad now. But I was sort of knocking around the place, going, "Am I ever going to write? Can writing be done?" And it was, again, I wouldn't even necessarily ask myself the question, because I was scared to answer it, perhaps. Yeah. But it was I have to say, it was the writing being published, even in a small way, even in journals, and then having novels published, is the far and away the most profound thing that has ever happened to me. It has changed my, I'm going grandiose again, and we're recording this at 11:30 in the morning. Yeah. So it sounds like it's 4 in the morning, but being published, being writing in a way that writing work that I felt proud of changed my view of myself. Changed my relationship with myself, and I just wish that for anyone else who writes, because it is a really, really, really huge part of your life if you can make it part of your life.
It is. That's, goodness, we are being very profound now.
Why not?
Absolutely. Well, I'm just thinking, Kit Dewall said something similar, you know, when she didn't start reading even until her 20s, you know. Okay. And yeah, it's an odd thing. It's odd is not the word, but it's a kind of mysterious thing to write, isn't it? It's like you discover, you were saying it's been a profound experience to you, but it's a sort of a discovery of yourself as well, isn't it?
It really is, and it's a gift to yourself, because you are making time out of life. You are trying to make a life in which you can spend however many hours a day, if you can, or hours a week, or whatever time you find to write. It's You could say it's self-indulgent. You could say it's an essential. I'm being published at the moment, and I hope to keep being published, but I won't always be being published. But I don't know what I'd do without writing. And, you know, if we were talking about mental health and well-being, I don't know what I would do without that. 90 minutes a few times a week where you get to do that.
Or do you turn into a monster when you're not writing?
I don't know, but a listless monster, maybe a distracted monster, you know. But it's really nice. I mean, I've written a few short stories, and I would love to do more. But I love the project of a novel, because you can lose yourself in it. There's nothing better than being maybe 2/3 of the way through a novel, knowing where it's going to end, because you think, okay, I kind of know where I'm going to be in my head for the next 9 months.
Yeah.
And that's a lovely feeling of security, because you don't know what to do with all those little noises in your head, and you can, okay, they're all gonna, and later on in a book, if a book is working, if a manuscript is working, every thought seems to relate to what's going on the page. So that's a lovely, a lovely feeling to have made for yourself.
Yeah, it's a lovely headspace. It's a lovely little universe to walk around in. I'm going to change tack a little bit to some levity. This is funny, because I would never really think of poetry and, you know, fun or good humor or laughter really in the same breath. Usually I think of poetry for very different reasons, but you have a poet here that you go to who makes you laugh.
He makes me laugh, and he makes me, you know, all the things we've been talking about up to now, he brings those feelings to. He has plenty of sadness, and, you know, he has poems, a lot of his poems are, he's a Serbian-American poet called Charles Simic, And an awful lot of his poems are about war and the aftermath of war and having had war in the sort of hinterland of your life. But he also, like Amy Bloom, writes about that at the same time as writing about pleasure and taking delight and the glee of being alive and the revelry to be had. And again, they can all coexist. They tend to coexist. There's a poem. Will I read a poem of his for you? I was going to read a poem just because I want to give you the title, called "My Father Attributed Immortality to Waiters." It's gorgeous. I recommend you, whoever's listening here, and they want to follow up on it, go and find it on Poem Hunter. Instead, it doesn't read very well when I try and read it. I'm going to read a poem called "Club Midnight," and it's from a collection called "Walking the Black Cat." Are you the sole owner of a seedy nightclub? Are you its sole customer, sole bartender, sole waiter prowling around the empty tables? Do you put on We Are Girly shows with dead stars of black and white films? Is your office upstairs over the neon lights or down deep in the rat cellar? Are bearded Russian thinkers your silent partners? Do you have a doorman by the name of Dostoevsky? Is Fu Manchu coming tonight? Is Miss Emily Dickinson? Do you happen to have an immortal soul? Do you have a sneaky suspicion that you have none? Is that why you flip a pair of white dice in the dark long after the joint closes?
Ooh.
Now, I find that funny. That's funny, isn't it? But it's also, everything's in there, isn't it?
Everything is in there, yeah. It's a bit shivery. It is. It's kind of, it's deceptively sort of, you know, light. And they have the dice in the dark.
Ooh. Yes. Do you happen to have an immortal soul?
Or
sneaking suspicion that you have?
Hello, existential crisis. Yeah.
You're on the hook there. No, his stuff, but he writes poems about, you know, all sorts. All life is there.
Is he? It sounds to me like he's quite outward looking, which is really refreshing, as well as introspective.
Yes, he writes in scenes a lot. He writes in the kind of images that, you know, he writes in, you can see everything, but there's always, it's quite absurd. I suppose most poetry lends itself to that. I've never written poetry, so I don't really have the language to talk about it. I read his work for pure pleasure. In fact, this I read to you from a collection called 60 Poems. What I've done in preparation, because we're talking in early December, in preparation for Christmas, I've taken down his collected poems and I put them on the shelf there to go, okay, I'm gonna have a little go at them over Christmas, because they're just, it's like eating, for me, it's like just, I don't know, eating chocolates or something, you know.
There you go, food again. We got it again.
I can't help it.
Looking at here, at there's another choice on the list here that our previous guest, Martina Devlin, could not speak highly enough of. It's your second book, The Mystery of Love. And you say here that you were writing the last chapter of that at a particular, during a particular life event. Do you want to tell us a bit about that?
It was. Thanks for bringing it up, because it's, and I'm conscious of the fact that I'm talking so matter-of-factly about my own sadness here. My mother died about 4 or 5 years ago. And, you know, she was old and had been living with cancer for quite a while. So it was a very, very sad death, but it was a death that I'd been prepared for. And it was, and I'd been writing, coincidentally, I'd been writing this book for a while. So in the weeks before it was clear that she was going to die, I was writing the last chapter of the book. And I thought, God, Andrew, this is ghoulish. You should. And I was doing it because I was living in Glasgow and she was in Dublin, where the rest of my family are. And I was flying back and forth. So I'd be sort of flying into Dublin airport on a Sunday morning, you know, writing the last chapter, getting the air coach out to Glasthool, spending a morning with her and getting the air coach back and going back to the last chapter. So I kind of realized, and the last chapter of The Mystery of Love, which is about a sort of I've slightly fictionalized Constance Wilde's last meeting with Oscar, her husband, because they had a few last meetings, as it were. But so I turned my last meeting with my mother into Constance's last meeting with Oscar. And when my partner, Anya, read the manuscript of the book, she goes, is this about you and your mum? And I went, is it that obvious? And you know, I say it now, but I felt, I don't know, is that opportunist? I mean, it's my emotional material. I could use it. And, So there's a sense of, in the final scene of The Mystery of Love, there's a sense of Constance letting go of Oscar. There's a sense of mercy. There's a sense of allowing somebody to be themselves in moments as they're slipping away from life. I mean, Oscar wasn't dying in the scene by any means. So, I don't know. I think the scene works and again, I'm sounding quite clinical here, talking about the emotional material. I think the scene works really well. It kind of came out in a oner. It didn't have much editing. I don't know if I'd been able to accept much editing of it had any big editing been offered. So I didn't write it in one sitting, but what I wrote just sort of landed on the page, and I went, okay, I got it. So I can look at that scene and go, that's me and my mum.
So that, in a way, your mum gave you that you were saying mercy, which is another word for grace, but that sense of mercy and grace, maybe your mum, that's a gift to you for that ending. There's the ending that you've been talking about.
I think that is a wallop of an ending, and that's what I'm going for. You're always going for that, but that things just came together for that. But the entire book was based around building up to this Constance and Oscar having this. You know, it's one of her prison visits, but it just came together. So I'm happy with that, and I used my own emotional material, but I suppose it's mine to use. So there you go.
There you go. And you're writing now. You're working on something now. Mm-hmm. Where are you on this new book?
I'm working on a new thing that we're always, you know, some smarter people than me are very superstitious about talking about their new work. But I'll talk to anyone who listened about this.
Okay, so you don't subscribe to that idea that it sort of evaporates if you talk about it too much.
I could do, but you know, if it's that wisp like that okay. evaporates from one conversation, God, it mustn't be that substantial at all. But although I'm quite far into, I have a draft of a manuscript, and I'm doing another pass on it now.
It's not as if you're at the kernel stage. So you're not talking about a little embryonic idea. You're talking about something that's concrete already. So I suppose that's.
And I'm working actually on the ending on another draft of the ending at the moment, and that's why I'm talking about emotional wallops. And you maybe if I'm sounding cheerful, because you've got me in a very rare good day. I just had a really good, and you know, there'll be a lot of writers listening to this, and Ruth, you know yourself, is that when you've had a good day, you're probably insufferable. And I had a good couple of hours on it this morning, and you know, sometimes you're writing and you go, if this book happens, and there's no guarantee that it will, it might evaporate or it might just, you know, not get its way in the world. If this book happens, those pages are going to be in it. And I thought, okay, that's nice. And that was, you know, it was the culmination of maybe a week of preparation for the morning I had this morning. So I'm writing an ending that I hope is going to be this phrase I'm using today, the emotional wallop. The book itself is, I don't know what terminology we use. It's a retelling or a reversioning of a Russian novel or a Russian novella called First Love by Ivan Turgenev, which is the story in Turgenev's original is the story of a young man who begins a very intense friendship with a slightly older young woman. And the book is all told from the young man's point of view. And he discovers later on that the young woman's secret love is the young man's father.
Oh, my God.
So that's emotionally brutal. And the morality, in a way, is Turgenev. So I do want to acknowledge that I'm using it as my source material. So if the book happens, I would like to say that it is, you know, this is a version of Turgenev. But I'm trying to triangulate the story. I'm telling the story from the three characters' points of view. So I'm going in and out of everyone's consciousness, and everyone has their interiority, and it's like my most recent book, Instant Fires. It's another summer love story set in Europe.
Another love story, see? Yeah.
And you get to be in love all the time. When I am in love in real life, but I get to be in love on the page all the time. And the fun I was having this morning on the page, I possibly was going over the top. I was talking early on about eating chocolates. I've had too many chocolates on the page earlier on today, but you know, I can always take it out. So that's why I'm sounding and insufferable because of one good day's work a year and you're unbearable.
You used that word, the what was the poet we were talking about, Charles Simic. You used the word glee. I have that circled on here. It's such a great word. And that's the word you could just use about your morning then. It's a bit of glee in that satisfaction.
And you know, some days you're kind of prepared for it and you're ready for it. And I was up, my partner was off for a work meeting really early. She had to leave to go to Newcastle, of all places, at 6 this morning. So I was here at 6 this morning at it. And by 9 o'clock, I thought, okay, that's me.
That's a gorgeous feeling. And what a beautiful morning for it. For anyone listening, we're just in that gorgeous cold snap and it's just stunning, stunning winter light. It's just sun and pure blue sky and freezing.
So I really don't mind crowing about it, Ruth. Yeah,
crow away.
Because I was talking about, you know, I was talking about bereavement there. I was talking about being sad and depressed in your 20s. So if you get the odd good day.
Oh God, take it. Get it while you can. Get it while you can, as the lady says. Yeah, indeed. Absolutely.
So I took it. And listen, I haven't written, nor have I actually read over what I've written this morning.
Oh, so, you know, give it 2 days. So give it 2 weeks. You'll read it again. You'll go, God, that's shit. What was I thinking?
It could be gobbledygook. but there'll be something.
I know when you get those moments, there's definitely, it's like when it all comes out in the one go you were saying earlier, when those, they're not that frequent, but when they happen, God, yeah, take it.
So I know I've taken it and I'm happy with it. And that was a good day. But let's see what the ghost of Turgenev, if he'll have the last laugh in terms of what I, again, that's another, that like the Joan Didion text, goodbye to all that. I read First Love so much in my earlier years that I kind of know it off by heart. So I haven't actually looked at it in a very, very long time. So I'm not sure, should I read it again before I finish my own thing? Because I've internalized that and metabolized that so much that I can do a cover version by heart. I don't need to look at the chords. So we'll see. Turgenev might get his revenge.
Are you allowed to say your title, or is that still under wraps for the new book? Or have you decided, or is it changing?
Well, I don't know. Again, this is another superstition that you shouldn't succumb to. I had a title. Last time I was talking to you about this, I had a title called For All the World to See. But that's changed now. It's now called There's a Field, I'll Meet You There.
Ooh.
And that's from the poet Rumi, where I've slightly rearranged the poet's syntax. But so at the moment it's called There's a Field.
I'll meet you there. I like that.
And I'm putting a comma where there's a full stop in the original poem. And that's me just thinking, okay, this is about love and people being drawn to each other. And so that's what it's called at the moment. But again, I'm talking about it. This is a manuscript. This is a Word file in my computer.
Oh yeah,
that I'm talking to people about. But I don't mind because it you know yourself how real it is. It exists. Even if it's a Word file in your computer, it still is something.
Oh, it does. It's there. Right, Andrew. The fun question. Two fun questions for me is. And actually, you said earlier on, and I kind of did a little, ooh, you actually did have a house fire. You did have a house fire and you did save the book from it. But in this hypothetical house fire now, is there a book that you would just leave in there?
Oh, God. God. Well, obviously, my copy of Slouching to Bethlehem wouldn't burn anyway, so I could leave that in the fire because it would probably survive again. Before I decide to reread First Love, the Turgenev novella, I might throw that in the fire as well and never reread it. And just so we'll throw that in the fire, First Love in the fire. Right. And again, it is indestructible. So if one Irish person in Glasgow throws it in the fire, the book's going to live on anyway. So it doesn't mind.
Rant. Okay, he's in there. And the last question then is. And you can't say your cat or your dog or your pet of any, the animals are excluded from this question. Is there any non-book item that you would save? One thing.
One collection of things is, we were talking about my mother earlier on, who passed away 5 years ago or so. I should really know when it was, about 5 years ago. And she worked for Kilkenny Design in the 1970s, early 80s. And there's in our house growing up, there was an awful lot of really nice kind of wonky looking ceramics and pottery. So I have an awful lot of her ceramics, like old sort of mad looking side plates. And there's a lot of them on the wall. And they're having, and I live in Glasgow now, and they're having a nice new life on the wall of my hall, for instance. One of my mother's side plates.
One of your mother's side plates. Okay.
Would come with me to continue its life, because it's having a new life here in Glasgow now, and maybe it would have another life if it got saved from a fire, and good for it.
Okay. Well, we're saving that. Andrew, before you go, I'm going to ask you to read a little bit from your novel that's out now with New Island, Instant Fires. So I'll just say thank you very, very much for chatting with me this morning. It was really, really nice to see you. And we're just going to end with a reading.
Lovely. I'll give a brief introduction. Instant Fires takes place over a week in summer in a town in Germany called Heidelberg. It's about a German woman called Ute Pfeiffer who goes home after about 15 years away. She goes home to visit her parents in Heidelberg, and living downstairs from her folks is a young Irish man called Seanie Donlan. And Seanie's kind of adrift. I won't quite say why. He's kind of drifting in and out of jobs. He's drifting in and out of relationships. And he and Ute begin a relationship. But here is just a very brief introduction to sort of Seanie's state of mind at the beginning of the book. This was the excitement of the last day in the job, a job lasting a week. There was the tang of freedom to it all, and the whisper of high season and his new handle on it. The remarkable events he might encounter, and the plan was, what was the plan? One day soon, he'd turn his head to listen to the sky, and a small bird he'd learn the name of, and he'd know then that the sad feelings would have passed from him. But the plan for now was to get the nose back in the books, concentration propelled by tea from a flask, packed lunches, a tin of mackerel for the omega-3s, some fruit, whatever was in season, sweetened by all the concentrating and thinking. He'd make it a summer of learning, little errands and wanders. There were paths to take to the holy mountain as far as his good ideas would let him. He'd take into himself for a spell. There'd be an understanding with the season. They would hold on to one another. And any trouble he'd get into would have come looking for him.
You've been listening to the wonderful Andrew Meehan reading from his latest book, Instant Fires, out now with New Island. You've been listening to Burning Books, and join us next time when I'll be talking to poet Liz Quirk. See you all then.